Welcome to Our Burning Questions, a professional learning podcast where we answer your most compelling questions about teaching, serving, and supporting multilingual learners. I'm your host, Jasmine Coaxum, and through our talks, I look forward to bringing the methods, philosophies, and stories behind teaching multilingual learners to light. Let's get into the show. Dr. J.P.B. Gerald, author of Anti-Social Language Teaching, English and the Pervasive Pathology of Whiteness. Truly a scholarly work that shakes the perceived educational foundation like a seismic earthquake, but quite the controversial title. He is here today to share how his book can help language teachers incorporate new ideas and reshape their pedagogy. Welcome, Dr. J.P.B. Gerald. We're so excited to have you on Our Burning Questions today. So first, you know, although the listeners have heard a little bit about you in terms of your work, in terms of your current book, why don't you tell us a little bit about your role right now in education?
Okay, so for people who don't know, I don't actually do professional language teaching anymore. I work in education management and program management for a nonprofit. It is not an educational nonprofit, as people might probably expect. However, they have an education arm that I'm in charge of the curriculum for. So we're a nonprofit lender. We give loans to people who the banks might not pay as much attention to, and I'm pretty sure you know who that means. But it's like, oh, it's an explicit racial justice purpose as the organization. And we also run these training programs for housing developers of color and other professionals of color. And I am in charge of the curriculum for the housing developers of color program.
Wow, okay. That sounds like really fulfilling work. So that's great. All right. So you're not in language teaching per se at this moment, but when you did decide that you were going to become an educator of L's, what actually led you to that decision?
You know, I want to say it's some deeply inspirational thing, but the truth of the matter is I was 21 and I was on my dad's couch and I needed a job. So I left the continent and went to teach overseas. A lot of people, I don't know about the specifics, but a lot of people have that story when they do the overseas thing. They're like, nothing's going on here. I got to go do something. So I went overseas and started teaching. And my second year overseas, I realized that I was actually pretty good at the connecting with students part, but I did not know anything like professionally about teaching. So I decided to go back to school and came back to New York and got my master's and so forth. I eventually left for reasons we can talk about later or now or whatever you'd like, but that's how it started.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you say it started that way. Yes, I think that that is the case for quite a few people who got into this field, but where it kind of takes a turn is that you decided to further educate yourself in terms of your teaching ability, right? I mean, you decided, even though it was kind of like, oh, let me just do this thing to get off of my dad's couch, it became, well, I want to learn more about this profession. So, I mean, what led you to even do that much instead of just saying, all right, I had my experience, I did my teaching abroad, and now, you know, that's that.
I mean, there were reasons that I gave at the time, but in retrospect, I think there were different reasons. So at the time, and we're talking about early 2010 at this point, I came back, or I wanted to further my studies, et cetera, et cetera. But I also just wanted to come home. Like, I enjoyed the fact that, like, I still very often tell people about my experiences in Asia because it was so different from the rest of my life in a lot of ways. The places I was able to see, I did a lot of solo traveling. You know, I still get ads from Hostel World because they're in my emails, and you know, everyone's reading your emails, right? But I wanted to come back to New York. The funny thing is that I actually ended up getting into a program that was online, so I didn't need to come back. But by the time I got in, I was already back. So I just wanted to come home, honestly. And I wanted to become good at it because I didn't know what I wanted to do for my career before teaching. And then even after the first year, I wasn't sure. And then when I decided, you know, this could be a career, I said, I want to be good at this. Like, I want to know what I'm doing. And so that's why I decided to further my studies there. And then I did that for several years and then eventually started my studies again, although that was not specifically based in language, despite what I ended up writing.
Okay, now, so tell me a little bit about, or tell us a little bit about what led you to the work that you are doing in this field, that, you know, in terms of the book that you wrote. What led you to this particular topic, to specifically whiteness, okay, in language teaching? Again, of course, in the book title is Pervasive Pathology of Whiteness. Okay, so I mean, what led you to go down that path in terms of your field of study?
Yeah, so I stopped teaching English as a main job at the end of 2016 because I had gotten a different job that was a direct precursor to this job where I was doing sort of curriculum development and training for adult workers, which obviously could be an English teaching job, but it wasn't. I got that job for pretty boring reasons that I think a lot of language teachers would understand. I wasn't making any money. So I changed to the other job. And then I was a employee of CUNY and they were giving you discounts because if you work at CUNY, you can go to the school for a discount, not for free, but I would get reimbursed for some portion of classes per year, right? So I said, all right, might as well see about a degree. And I was thinking about just getting some certificate in like data science. And then I tried to learn data science and I was bad at it. So I stopped. it's the kind of thing where I realized like, I was just gonna, because there are just like certificates you could take, this like one or two classes, right? And they're very asynchronous. And I think there's a value to asynchronous learning. I think it can be used for certain things, but for something that was anathema to what I'd learned in terms of, you know, I don't have those skills innately, I needed a teacher. And I said, you know what, I kind of want to be taught. So I decided to go back to school again. And in my program, you know, I wrote down, you have to write, you know, an essay to get in, like, what do you want to research? You know, it's a doctoral program. And my essay, you know, I certainly realized that my job at the time, which in retrospect was a pretty bad job, but it got me this job, so I can't complain, was not going to be a place that any of my research would apply. It was very regimented because we were working not for, but with the government, and the government has a lot of regulations and so forth. So there was not going to be any way that I could speak directly to my current experience in that. So I thought back to my previous experience as a language teacher, and I started writing about that. So then, in my program, I got in, obviously, and then in my second semester, I was in a language research class. The degree was not language research, but you had to take different research classes. One was like disabilities, one was language teaching, and one was literacy, that kind of thing. So the language teaching one came first for me just by chance. They all rotated, and by chance, my year, that one was first. And I go in there like, I know this, I got this. Some of it I did know, but then I said, I want to push this further. And I had a couple of experiences, which are in the book, where I realized that, you know what? All this time I spent in the language field, I knew the field was not exactly diverse. And it thinks it's diverse because people speak many languages, but you know what I mean.
Yes.
I realized that nobody wanted to talk about that. And it was weird. Because I had not spent a lot of time talking about it with other language teachers, because I just, you know, I had just been trying to get on to get on, you know, like, let me put my head down. And part of the reason that it's hard for this field to change is because if people are stressed about their bills, they're not going to spend all the time organizing the fight stuff. But I said, that's interesting. So I started having conversations and people got really uncomfortable. And I was not even accusing them of anything. I'm just asking them questions. They didn't want to answer my questions. So I started writing about the fact that people didn't want to answer my questions. And then I mean, it's really what happened, right? And then I got to I wrote another article that was more like, no, I need to be more forceful about this. That article came out in May of 2020. It was was about decentering whiteness and language teaching, which ultimately is a much, much shorter version of my book. And people gave me some talks and, you know, I was doing podcast. I already had my own podcast. And so people knew who I was. And then the publisher approached me about writing the book. Now the connection to pathology and so forth is that I wanted a sort of unique angle because I could have just written in a literally extended version of my article that would have just been like decentering whiteness and language teaching. That is the point of the book, but I needed to ground it in something larger than that because like, it's just a very academic title to say decentering whiteness and language teaching, which is also what the title of my previous article was, and it's an academic article, right? I wanted it to really connect to larger ideas, and I realized that one of the underexplored intersections is between not just race and language, which is underexplored but is being explored, and not just race and disability, which has been explored for a very long time, and not just perhaps language and disability, but what about all three? And so I could not find anything, at least when I had gotten approached about the book, that combined all three things. And I was working on an unrelated essay that I never did anything with because I used it for the book that was about language and disability. And I said, well, what if I bring all these things together? And they accepted the proposal, so I wrote it. The idea of the pathology is that, you know, many groups in our society, which is both the United States or the West or whatever you want to call it, are stigmatized. We know this. This is ultimately what the power structure of racism, sexism, and so forth is. It's about it's not just people being different, it's stigmatizing the people with less power. They don't just have less power, they have less power because something's wrong with them, right? If there's nothing wrong with them and they simply have less power because we took power from them, then we are the bad guys. And nobody wants that to be the case. So people construct reasons why, well, this is why the Black people deserve to have less power. This is why people who don't speak English deserve to have less power, right? It's not just that we don't let them have power, it's that there's something wrong with them. And one of the age-old ways that we decide that something is wrong with people is to say that there's something like medically, mentally, et cetera, wrong with them. But if you think about who's constructed all of these symptoms and diagnoses, it sure isn't the people that they're talking about. It's the people who had more power than them. And I wanted to make the point that the system that stigmatizes people is itself worthy of stigma.
Okay. I think that your answer really took us in... I mean, it definitely took us in the direction of how you kind of started this. And I think that's really interesting because a lot of times, you know, we notice things around us that ultimately impact us in very strong ways, but yet we don't all necessarily kind of really do a deep dive into those things and then bring those things to light and kind of make other people also take notice of those particular things, right? So I think that's great that's how you started with this work. Now, there's a few things, well, there's lots of really juicy nuggets in your book. But one of the things that you mention is that you have spent your entire life immersed in white spaces. So first, for those who might be questioning, what does he mean immersed in white spaces? What does it mean really to be immersed in whiteness? And how would you sum up the impact that this has actually had on you?
So, I mean, it's pretty straightforward in some ways, but it's not straightforward in others, right? Like, I think it's not hard for someone to understand a white space in the sense that if you are literally the only person of color in a space, that's mostly a white space, right? That's not, I don't think I need to explain that to people, but I think it's a little bit different than that because that part is straightforward. And if that were the case, then, you know, I could just leave, right? You know what I'm saying? Like if I lived in a white neighborhood, I could just not live there. Right. I'm not saying it's easy for people to move, but if it was all about like a place where everyone is white, you could literally just not be in that place. But the point I'm making and the point, and this is in various literature, people can do this research, is that the concept of a white space is not just the place where the white people are. It's a place where whiteness is prized, right? A place physically or a place ideologically or whatever. So for example, if you are in a certain type of school, if the standards and the structures and the ideals favor whiteness, then that's still a white space, even if everybody in the building is Black, right? Or another place you could think of, and I'm not saying I spent time in this place, but like prison's a white space, even if everybody in the prison is Black, you know, because they built it and they constructed it a certain way. Right. Or if you want to think of the entire United States, not the land, which is certainly not white, but the concept of the country, the whole thing is unfortunately a white space, right? Because it was made up. So, you know, if we, I could, now that's very abstract to say that everyone in the United States is in a white space, but I'm talking about my life. I'm talking literally in that I was in white schools, right? And I'm talking figuratively in that, like, not only were a lot of my friends white because people are friends with their classmates, but also the ideals, the goals, the way people were valued and not valued was white around me. And it took me a very long time to recognize that that was not just people are different from me, but that they were certainly seeing more of an ideal than I was, so that when I diverged, I wasn't just different, but I was shamed. And it took me far too long to understand that, because it probably did some psychological damage to me, which I talk about in the book. But on the other hand, as an adolescent, you do whatever you can to fit in. And I realized that what I was doing to fit in was pretty harmful, unfortunately, harmful mostly to myself, I mean. And so taking a step back and being really critical of the spaces I was in, because they weren't, again, outwardly cruel to me. What people don't tend to understand about this, and I know you understand, but people don't tend to understand about this, is that it's very rarely someone coming up to you and punching you in the face, right? It's very rarely, you know, actual slurs. I mean, that happens and it's happened to me, but I'm not really talking about that. I'm just talking about a place where you have to put in so much effort to prove your value. Because it is automatically assumed that you are less valuable. I'm talking about a situation where they don't think about what they're saying and how it would generate different groups of people in different places. I'm talking about looking at a job saying, we want to hire someone for diversity. And then you look at the picture of all the employees and it is diverse. You're like, great. And then you look at the picture of the leadership and you're like, oh, wait a second. And I always look up leadership now. I'm not looking for a job now, but when I was looking at jobs a year ago, like that's one thing I looked up. I always looked up the leadership. I'm like, are they talking the talk? Are they walking the walk? And when you think about that and think about the power structure involved, or when you say things like, a job is going to say, yeah, we'll pay you $26,000 a year, but you have to have a master's degree. Who on earth is going to be able to afford to live that way other than someone with generational wealth or a wealthy spouse, right? So all of those things are tied to the same ideas.
Well, I really love the way you define this, right? And I think a lot of times people's definitions do stop in that initial place that you first explained, right? Oh, white space. It just means that you're the only person of color in a specific area, school, et cetera, where there are majority white people. But I think, in fact, also in the book, you do a really great job of defining terms that I think people just kind of maybe give blanket definitions to, or just have listened to the blanketed definitions of some of these terms and not really gone kind of deeper in terms of understanding them and how they can really impact your or one's situation, one's social situation, financial situation, et cetera, in society. So for example, the way that you have defined racism in your book, that you have defined anti-Blackness in your book, the way that you have defined being antisocial and what that means in your book, I think it's a really just great source of education for people who really would like to actually understand these terms more in depth. So now I'm just going to go back a little bit to this idea of social discomfort and where, you know, it actually comes from when you're put into these spaces. So you know, in your book, when you refer to the impact of racism, you mentioned that you chalked it up to your social discomfort, and you perceived that discomfort as your own deficits, right? So I want to take this to our students, the L's, right? So do you think this is what our L students do when they aren't meeting the standard way of speaking, way of looking, way of being? Do you think that they kind of chalk it up to their own deficits? And if this is the case, how can we as educators address this?
Well, I don't know. I can't speak for every student, right? So I'm sure some of them don't. But, you know, there's research on this. It's not necessarily comprehensive for every student in the United States. But like, you know, I said in the book that, like, for example, in South Korea, they have to take a college entrance exam that involves English. They don't really need to use English. They just have to take this test, right? Which will change their career prospects, even though there's no real reason to use English every day there. Right. And, you know, they interview people studying for the test and it's like, oh, did you feel like it gave you a closer relationship to English or whatever? And they're like, not really. I kind of hate English now. they did probably better on the test because they were forced to learn the stuff, right?
Right, right.
It was not helpful to them. These were adults. So if it's not helpful for them and it's affecting, like, you know, young adults and stuff like that, I can't imagine it'll be easier for these students. So the one thing I'll add to that is that, like, are they necessarily sitting there and saying, oh man, I did not do well on this test because I am not intelligent or whatever it is? Like, I don't know, right? But I will say that if they start to see who is accepted and they start to see the trends in who's accepted and they add it to all the cultural information they're getting, then even if they're not super conscious of this, it's in there, right? Because ultimately, if it's literally about, you know, passing a written test or something like that, well, then your accent and all that probably doesn't matter that much, right? Because, you know, that they don't know who you are when you take a test like that. But even if you do well on a test, if the idea is that you need to do this, because ultimately, let's think about this, even if we're talking about middle school, even if we're talking about high school, yes, we can say the idea is to get into a better college, but is the point of just getting them to college is at the end? No, ultimately the point is for them to make more money. And I'm not saying it should be the point, but that's the way this stuff is constructed. That's why we have the whole, like, we need to pass the test. It's money for the school. And also 6, 7, 8, 9 years later, it's supposed to improve people's career prospects. So one of the reasons I'm bringing that up is because they might be able to do well on the test or not. And I'm not saying that there aren't ways to improve people's test scores. It's just that I don't really care. But I will say that, like, when they come to being age 25, 26, and then trying to get certain jobs, and they did all the tests well, but people still aren't hiring them because of, well, they'll say it's other reasons, but they'll say, you know, you're not the right fit, but it turns out to be something else. They're just going to be in for a rude awakening, because ultimately basing things on tests is meritocratic, right? It's this idea that if you work hard, you know, you'll get these rewards. And is that literally true of a test? Probably, right? In the sense that, like, you know, the people who prepare for a test probably do better on it. Although I almost never study for tests because I'm good at tests and I tend to do well, but not everybody's like me. But the point is, trying to teach people who are in a less powerful position in society that, well, if you just work hard, this will be better, it has a documented negative impact because people figure things out. When they're 10, they might not figure it out, right? And they did this study with kids of color in, I don't know, I think it was Illinois or something. Don't quote me on that. But the point is somewhere in the Midwest. And these kids believed strongly in meritocracy when they were like 10, 11. And then they checked with them 3-4 years later. And the people who believed more strongly in meritocracy, if they were in a racialized or minoritized group, actually did worse academically over the next several years, because whatever happened, they probably figured out that the meritocracy stuff was nonsense and it ruined their motivation. So the point is, if we're trying to push meritocratic ideals on people to say, if you just work hard, this will happen, and then the thing doesn't happen, well, that's just a lot worse. So anyway.
Okay. So it sounds rather hopeless, actually. I mean, it just cycle, which is...
It's hopeless if we don't change it, because the thing is, I wouldn't bother to do this sort of writing if I didn't think that there was a useful way to communicate and teach the language, right? The testing cycle is pretty hopeless because it's a money thing, right? So, like, the only reason these things exist is because they can sell it. And I don't just mean, it's not like a conspiracy. It's pretty straightforward. It's not hidden, right? You know, it's much easier to market your textbooks if there is a very specific way that people need to speak English, right? You can't, right? It would be much harder to market a textbook if everyone's English was accepted. If everyone's English was accepted, then there's no right way, and then they can't sell a textbook, right? If everyone's English is accepted, then, you know, the test people will not make nearly as much money, right? And if there's no right way or no one right way, then there's no accent reduction industry, right? And if there's no one right way, then they can't justify who they hire at different places for more perceived income and so forth. So this is all premised around, the point I'm obviously talking about capitalism, it's not just capitalism, I just mean greed in general, is that like they will use whatever reasons they want to use, but ultimately they do not find that people who do not speak English a certain way are as economically valuable. It's as simple as that.
Okay, I would like to take this back now to educators and how we can address this. I mean, I wanted to say these issues, but I just feel like I don't want to really call them issues. I just want to call it like a way of being, a way that society is just structured in a way that a lot of people have just accepted as the norm. And again, maybe turned to themselves and said, well, I must not have, you know, worked hard enough. That's why I still haven't gotten ahead. So some people are doing that while others are doing what you said, noticing it's not me. It's the way the structure is kind of set up. So, you know, from the start as educators, what can be done?
I mean, I say this a lot whenever I show up on podcasts, and I say this when I give talks, that ultimately it's like pushing a boulder up a hill if the structure stays the same, right? It's just mm-hmm. going to roll over you eventually. So I get why some people don't even bother. It's like, let me just do my job and whatever. And again, a lot of that is because people feel economically stretched. If you don't feel like you have a comfortable salary, you're just like, I'm just going to punch the clock and get it done. Right? So there's that. But on the other hand, if someone feels like they have any extra energy left over, like the boring answer is you really got to do a lot of this reading and talking. Like I think I don't want to tell people go do these three actions in your job, because first of all, everybody's job is different. I don't know what your principal is going to say. I don't know what your director is going to say. Like, I don't know where you work, right? So if I try to give, like Justin said, do these three things, you know, they're not going to work. So no, I'm not saying you said that. I'm saying people think that way sometimes. They're like, give me a checklist, and no checklist. But I will say that like the real work is building a coalition of people where you're going to have these conversations and push each other and be wrong and learn and continue. Because in all the research on people learning to challenge racism, and I know we're talking about more than racism, but that's what my book is about. There is a pretty clear pattern in that the people who care about it, which is not everybody, but most people, they start to learn, they get sort of overwhelmed by how much there is, and then they start to realize, and this is the inflection point, they realize, oh my God, I've been complicit in this. And then they just give up because it's sometimes too hard. Or they don't have that roadblock, and then they hit the other roadblock as they try something, and the something they try doesn't work, and then they give up. Right? Because they have the option to give up if they're in the majoritized group, right? I can't really give up. I can't just like, well, I don't really care about racism. Like I have to, I have a son, you know? So I would say I mentioned those roadblocks, the way to get over those roadblocks is to build a community where you can talk about these things, right? Where you can figure out like, hey, I'm trying to do this at my job. What do you think? Hey, I really want to challenge some, you know, school board restriction or whatever. Can you do this with me? Right? It's the solidarity is as an educator is the only way, because ultimately all of this is like a construction site. This is backfill, right? They already dug out the hole and now we have to put all the dirt back in, and it shouldn't be that way. This should be part of the excavation. The metaphor meaning when people are trained to be teachers, it should be in there, but since it's not, then we have to do this when people are already in their careers. And I think that's what's hard, because part of the reason I never really considered this until several years later, and even when I wasn't even teaching language anymore, is because you realize, oh man, all these things I learned, I did all these things wrong earlier in my career, and you can't undo those things. And that is understandably difficult to sit with. And it's part of the reason I wrote my book, and it says this in the book, that I realized that even though I care deeply about my students and I really wanted them to succeed, I still thought, unfortunately, that they needed to, like, for example, improve their confidence. They did, but it was mostly that we established a relationship and they were still confident, but then they walked in the street and the people still treated them like garbage because of the way that they spoke. And I really hadn't considered the way that the system doesn't really care how confident you are in the classroom, right? You go down the street, try to order something, the people are gonna get mad at you. That, my classroom can't fix that, right? So I regret a lot of the ways that I taught at the beginning, even though I was very caring, and it's really hard to get over that hurdle. The point is, this needs to be in the training, but if it's not, and most people listening to this presumably have already started their career, so therefore it probably wasn't in their training, you got to seek it out. And I know we're all busy, so if you're a classroom teacher, do it over the summer, I don't care. But like, find this information, talk to people about it, go to as many places, whether it's virtually or in person, that are having these discussions, and build a robust solidarity of people, whether it's in your district, in your county, in your Auburn, right, in your state, whatever it is, or across the country, so that you don't feel defeated when something you try doesn't work, so that you don't feel that you're doing this by yourself, so that you don't worry about doing something wrong and giving up and so forth. So the short answer, which I did not do, is solidarity and coalition building, which I know is a pretty boring answer, but it's not, because it's the only way any of this stuff is gonna work.
Right, you know, despite the answer not being the short version of the answer, I did pick out solidarity, right? And so in using that solidarity to build a type of foundation so that you feel stronger when you decide to maybe deviate from practices that have been kind of ingrained in the system and in your learning for quite some time. So speaking about learning, okay, I know that you did some classes, right? I mean, you basically taught classes on decentering whiteness. And I'm sure that our listeners are really curious in terms of what the curriculum is for such a class.
Well, the whole curriculum is in the book. But the short, like literally, like.
Well, for those who haven't gotten
the
book, hopefully they will get the book after.
I'm going to summarize it and then say that you need to read the book for, you know, whatever, because I'm not going to describe an entire syllabus on the podcast. But so the actual syllabus is in the book. So you should get it if you want that, because even if people just want to buy the book so they can have a syllabus about decentering whiteness, fine, because I still get the money. But the point is, that's why I put it in there. You want to use it? You have to go to the book and you have, because people will steal, you know, syllabi and so forth. But the point is, it's a short class, right? It was only like 6 classes and it was only like an hour each. But I also feel like you can't extrinsically motivate adults very well. You can do that for a short period of time, and I'll explain it in a second. You can do that for a short period of time. Like, I'll give you $100,000 to do this thing. Let me tell you, in my job right now, we gave people a grant, and as part of the grant, they had to do X, Y, and Z. The people who weren't intrinsically motivated stopped doing the stuff. We gave them a lot of money. Just extrinsically motivated people.
I'm not surprised. Adults.
It works for only a short period of time.
Right. Right.
I'll give you $20 if you do this thing. Yeah, you better be doing that. Like, the thing needs to happen right now. Intrinsic motivation, at which I'm sure anyone who doesn't understand, inside of you, right, is the only thing that carries for adults especially, right? We're talking about teachers, so we're talking about adults. So, the people who signed up for my class had to be intrinsically motivated, which is to say the length of the class is not going to help. Like, if I did it for 30 weeks, you know, fine, but like it was going to be up to them to figure out what to do. Because like I said, not only do I not know what's going on in each person's job, and I say that to be very clear, like I'm not trying to use it as a cop out. Like, I literally can't say you in a college or you in a middle school should do the same thing, because each context is different. I'm trying to give people tools to examine themselves and their own context and then figure out what to do. And then they were welcome to talk to me afterwards. But the structure of the class, and this was 2020 and 2021, everything was Zoom, but also people were in different places, so it would have been Zoom anyway. We had 6 classes where we talked about different aspects of whiteness, and they were supposed to, at the end of it, come up with an action plan for what to do in their context. Now, I meant their jobs, but they could have used their communities and neighborhoods if they wanted to. And I actually interviewed them for the book to say, okay, so what did you do? And I interviewed them for my dissertation also to be like, so what did you do, right? Because I was curious after the class what they did. And almost all of them told me that the things that they tried to do hadn't really gotten very far, because it takes a long time to do these things and it's hard, and everything that they assumed would work might not work. And the only people who were able to do so are people who had more power in the first place. Like, I had a provost of a college in my class, right? And he actually changed some policies because he had enough power to do that. The people who were, even the professors, didn't have enough power to change any policy. They could change how they taught, but those people ended up changing their lives, right? Now, is that as important as changing policies at work? I don't know. I think it depends on the person. But like, these people are people who, whether or not they're able to change their work at school, they decided, you know, we can't really go into this church anymore. They're not really being supportive of racial justice, right? This is a white family in a white church saying, like, we can't go there anymore. It's a big deal for people who are religious, right? To just say, I'm not going to my church anymore, you know? So this is to say that the whole point of the class, which we want the 4 main topics, right? They had to come in and do a racial autobiography, and anyone listening to this should do that, which is sit down and think about how they learned that they were the race that they are, right? Especially for white people, because Black folks and people of color, I think we all know when we found out we were various races, because usually something bad happens. But the white folks in my classes, they usually never really thought about being white. Like, obviously they knew they were white, they check it off on a form, but they never really thought about it as a separate entity until they were like young adults, really, you know? It's changing now. Younger kids think more about it, but this is people who are older. So then we talked about, you know, workplaces and how whiteness shows up there. We talked about living spaces, right? And how whiteness shows up in communities. What I really try to emphasize with the communities part is that not only are very white spaces bad for the people of color there for obvious reasons, but it's bad for the raising of those white kids. You could be a very progressive person, and if you happen to live in a very progressive but very white place, like most of New England, you are going to only be exposing your kids to what they are going to see as normal. Wherever your kids grow up is going to be what they see as normal. And that has nothing to do with race. That's just, here is what my environment is. And if the only thing they see as normal is the people who look like them, they're not necessarily going to hate people who look different, but it's still not going to be a direct peer-to-peer experience. And as much as you as a white parent teach them, it's still not the same as them knowing people of color as peers. And if you say, well, we do see people of color around, what do you mean, the janitor, right? Or you mean the person who picks you up from school? That is not a peer relationship, okay? So it's really bad for the white kids if you want to raise them to focus on racial justice to keep living in a place that doesn't have it. So that's another thing. We talked about white saviors, because I tell people all this stuff and it's very easy to internalize it and say, well, I better go fix everything myself. No, because that's part of the problem is that you get a lot of savior attitudes. Like the, I use a podcast episode about Renee Bach. If you're listening to this, go look her up. She was like 19, a church girl from Texas who said she wanted to fix Africa. She went to Uganda, opened a clinic, and like 95 kids died or something like that. So she wasn't intending to do that, but like they trusted her because she's this white lady and she didn't know, she's not a doctor. So, you know, she's trying to save all the people and people are donating to her. And then, you know, she got fined something like $700 because, you know, that was her punishment. So anyway.
Wait a minute. $700 for 95 lives? I think it was $700 lives?
A person. Sorry, $700.
Oh, okay. I just...
But still, I know. $700 for like a child that died, right?
Right.
Part of it is that like these children were malnourished, so they couldn't prove that they wouldn't have died had she not, like she didn't, like some of them would have died anyway, is the point. Because they were very malnourished, but she did not help them. And some of them probably died because of her intervention, not knowing what she was doing. So I tell people like, after the white savior part, then I say, all right, go back and think about your context. What can you do? And then they come with an action plan that's critiqued by their peers and by me. Now, I haven't taught this class in a while because I finished school and, you know, I'm just doing other stuff now, although I'll teach it if anybody's interested. But yeah, that was the plan there. And, you know, it was fun. I really enjoyed that class. It was a lot of work in the sense that, like, I had to juggle it with my like son and everything. But I think people got a lot out of it. These days, you know, I haven't taught it much, but I still try to put that energy out in the world with the podcast and anything that I show up on and with the book. And, you know, I'm trying to put together a follow-up book, although I do want to be clear that the follow-up book would most likely not be a language teaching book, because frankly, I don't have a whole lot more to say to the field of language teaching in a book form, because frankly, they all need to just read that one. And if they don't do what I said in that book and they don't decenter whiteness, then what else can I really say? It's not going to change.
So, I mean, if people pick up the book, they look at the syllabus, can other people spread the word per se? Like, can other people learn how to actually teach these classes to members of their educational staff?
I think that they could. I told people that, you know, you are welcome to use this syllabus because otherwise I wouldn't have put it in there. But I told people to be very careful. It is not a syllabus you can take off the shelf, because, and it says this in the book and in the syllabus, that the person leading this has to be very, very secure in their own identity. They have to be very open and honest and vulnerable about their own racial experience. So if you are not, you cannot come into this class presenting yourself as an all-knowing expert. You know, if you think about Paulo Freire and the idea of the banking system of education, I do not claim to know anything about these people's lives. Yeah, maybe I'm friends with them, then I know some things about their lives just because I know them, but like, I do not claim to know their racial story. In fact, some of these people were people I were friends with for a long time, and I did not know their racial story. Like, I knew that they were white, for example, but like, I didn't know how they did or didn't get taught race when they were a kid. People are going to have to be very, very honest. And the instructor has to be equally honest, because the first thing that happens in the class is I give a little presentation and then I talk about myself and my own journey. So like, if you are not comfortable with that, basically you need to do a lot of work before you can pull this one off the shelf. And honestly, I would say if you are thinking of pulling it off the shelf, then you can't do it. Because if you're thinking like, I'll just do this without doing any work, then right. you are exactly the wrong person to do it. However, if you've done the work and you feel confident in it, then that's when you take a shot at it. Because it's not the kind of thing you can just pull off the shelf.
Now, in the prologue of the book, you do say that you hope educators will find your work resonant enough to employ as part of their pedagogy. So, I mean, we were just talking about, you know, not being able to take a syllabus and run with it. So how could educators essentially implement your work as part of their pedagogy? What kind of advice could you give there? For those who obviously haven't read the book, because it says, yeah, that through this book, you know, you're kind of hoping that educators will be able to do this. So what exactly?
Well, I mean, it's the kind of thing that's hard to say unless someone's literally reading the book, because if you haven't read it, what I'm going to say next doesn't make a lot of sense. And I don't mean that it's like a secret. I just mean like, this is not the kind of book that you are supposed to just sort of pick up and put back down and pick up and put back down. I'm hoping, at least for an academic book, because it's still not, obviously it's not the same as a mass market book because those are for a different audience, but still an academic book. But my hope is that there's sort of a visceral reaction to it, for good or bad, although I don't expect people to buy it if their reaction would be bad. I saw people's faces when I was at the Nice TESOL conference, and I told people they are interested. I'm sitting there with the book, and I'm telling them about the book, and they read the title and then they just sort of walk away. So, you know, it's not the kind of book you're going to read all the way through if you're not interested. If you do read all the way through it, my point is that the lessons, and hopefully the lesson isn't just me telling people stuff, but them learning from the fact that I've been so vulnerable in the book, that like they need to step out of their comfort zone and really do the work. So in that sense, I think that they should employ the lessons of the book, which is the connections between different axes of oppression and the way that filters into language education, more so than I mean you should just take this syllabus and use it. Right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I mean, in your book, again, right, you talk about it being kind of this vision for the future of the ELT field. So, and you say, you know, based on your research findings and experience, once again, you know, you refer to this book as a vision for the future for the ELT field. So again, for the people who haven't read it, what exactly does that future look like? And have you seen it really like at least start to take shape since you've written this book and since you've been disseminating this knowledge?
I mean, no.
But all right, that's I think the first question that you've just answered with just one word. Okay.
But also in the sense that it just hasn't been that much time, so how much could it really change, right? But what I mean is that like what I'm encouraged by is that, you know, it's an academic book, so quote unquote successful is a very different thing than it is for like a novel written by James Patterson, right? Like my publisher is very happy with the amount that I've sold, but it's not like 40,000 copies or anything like that. So my point is, there's only gonna be so much influence. But what I mean is that I am hearing stories of resonance. I'm hearing that people who read it feel heard. I'm hearing that people who are white who read it feel like, oh man, I really need to change some things about it. And I wanna go back and look at that section again. And I'm hearing that, you know, it's having a, I'd rather have a strong impact on a small number of people than a very small impact on a large number of people. Some people will feel differently, but I know that I am a niche popular person. And so I'm going to use my niche and push it as far as I can. So the vision that you're sort of hinting at is it's really one that centers the true value of the students and the teachers, especially as teachers of color are another aspect of this that are an issue, that no one is really thought of as lesser because of their identity, which seems obvious. And yet, if you haven't read this work, you might not understand the ways in which we do it unintentionally. I think that's the gist of what I want to see in the future, is that what is idealized is not one form of English or one type of person, because that's really the same thing, but what's idealized is people who, you know, connect with the language or whatever, right? I think that, for example, hiring overseas shouldn't be based on your passport, right? Hiring overseas should be based on the person's potential connection to where they want to teach. I should not have been hired for that job in South Korea because I didn't know anything about South Korea. Yeah, I did some research on the internet, but it was not required for me to do any research about South Korea. So like that's the whole EFL in that sense, you shouldn't be sent to a country where you don't know anything, but you know you'll be okay because you are American or British or whatever, right? That's just colonialism in miniature. We should not be basing everything around tests, which is not unique to language teaching, but is a big problem. And we really need to think about getting the profit motive out of it. I know that, again, it's not unique to language teaching, but is, you know, it's a thing. So the vision I want is where people are really valued fully, and in the classroom, they're not stigmatized for, you know, being different.
Now, you very explicitly in the book say that the system of ELT is broken. So one final question before we go today, and that is, what burning question should today's educators consider in order to improve their service to the L community?
What hierarchies are you enforcing without intending to? I think I'm gonna leave it at that, because that's a lot of the whole point of this is that I would say every binary becomes a hierarchy one way or another. So if you are enforcing a binary between English learner and not English learner, or a binary between American and not American, right? All those binaries, they're never equal, right? Think about the binary, and the point of this us busting up the gender binary is the same thing, right? You don't say, well, there's men and there's women. Well, it sure isn't equal, right? And that's part of the reason we're challenging gender binaries in a lot of ways. So every binary becomes a hierarchy. So what hierarchies and therefore what binaries are you enforcing unintentionally? Think about that. And if you start to realize the way that you are doing that, I think you will go a long way. Hopefully that resonates with people.
Okay, thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Gerald. And we look forward to this next iteration of the book, even if it's not necessarily about language.
Oh, it's about language. It's not about language teaching.
All right, great. So thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for tuning in to Our Burning Questions, produced by Mid-State Auburn at OCM BOCES. If you would like to learn more about today's guest or any of the resources we discussed, please visit Mid-State Auburn's webpage at ocmboces.org. That's ocmboces.org. Join us next time, where we hope to answer more of your burning questions.